Welcome. You are listening to the Better Together podcast with Callie and Rosario Picardo. We take on topics involving marriage, ministry, parenting, communication, relationships, and other subjects that our listeners want to hear more about.
Welcome to another edition of the Better Together podcast. I am your host, Rosario Picardo, and I have a special guest with us today, Josh McNall. And Josh is actually Dr. McNall. He is a professor at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and he helps with the pastoral theology. And he's written a new book that we are eager to hear about that I think is pertinent not only to Orthodox Christianity, but also just in how we live our lives. Josh, welcome to the Better Together podcast.
Ross, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, so you're a professor and you're a writer, and you've just written this new book. Share the title with us and what it's about.
Yeah, the title is How Jesus Saves, and then the subtitle is Atonement for Ordinary People. And the subtitle kind of tells what the book is or who it's for, really. It's on the doctrine of atonement, which is about how Jesus saves us by virtue of his death and his resurrection and sending his spirit. But that's a topic that is mostly discussed by academics in academic books, you know, for other professors. And I wanted to write a book, especially as we approach the Easter season and we're in Lent right now, heading into Good Friday. I wanted to write a book on how Jesus saves that's for ordinary people. It's not for pastors necessarily or for scholars, but for just regular folks.
What gave you the burden in wanting to write this? Because I know from experience, you have to have, any kind of writing is a labor of love, right? Mm. So what was the motivation behind this? Like, what need did you see arise?
Yeah, the need really I talk about in the introduction, I had just written a really big book for academics on the doctrine of atonement. It's called The Mosaic of Atonement. And it was really well received by other professors and scholars, in which I joke about in this book. I what that means is that you've never heard of it if you're just like a regular person. And so I had just written this other academic book on how Jesus saves. And then one night I was putting my daughter Lucy to bed, and she turns to me and she asks me, she says, you know, Dad, how does Jesus save us by dying on the cross? And, you know, just a super simple question from a little kid. And we don't always know where those bedtime questions come from. Sometimes they're stall tactics to try to delay, you know, the inevitable time to go to sleep. But I knew in this case, my daughter was asking it in part because we had just been to a funeral and a loved one had passed away at a young age, tragically. And she knew, even as a little kid, like, death is not something we celebrate. It's not good news. But why do we talk about the death of Jesus on the cross as a part of how God saves us? And so it was a super simple question. Dad, how does Jesus save us by dying on the cross? And what I discovered was, as I kind of stumbled through different answers, I mean, after all, I had just written this big book on atonement doctrine, I ought to have like a decent answer. Some of the bigger theological words and some of the different ways of approaching it that were helpful for academics weren't super helpful for a kid. And also maybe aren't super helpful for just regular Christians, you know, who attend church or who are interested in Jesus, but they don't have PhDs in theology. And so that's the spark for this book. I wanted to write a book about how Jesus saves and the doctrine of atonement, but for ordinary people, not just for other professors to sort of debate or discuss.
Yeah. And you mentioned we're in the season of Lent, and, you know, Lent is practiced or observed more, of course, the Catholic Church, Orthodox, mainline, but there's something that we lost in Protestantism, moving away from those traditions where we want to skip over the journey of Lent and get to Resurrection Sunday morning, which everybody wants, right? but we forget about the atoning sacrifice that Christ asks us to follow as well. So as you were writing this, any kind of surprises to you that, I mean, any surprising discoveries? I mean, you're a PhD, you wrote a huge, book about this, as you mentioned, but anything that personally impacted you as well, like any surprises as you were writing this piece?
Yeah, I think, one thing that people say is that even as a scholar, you don't truly have a good grasp on what you're talking about unless you can put it into language and words that ordinary folks can understand. And sometimes we hide behind big words, or we hide behind complexity because we don't really quite know what we're talking about. And so I think it was important for me to try to find stories and analogies and metaphors that could help bring into clarity what Jesus is doing in the cross and in the resurrection. I don't pretend that I've fully, wrapped my mind or my words around it. I think if you can reduce Christ's work to a bumper sticker, then you're probably not talking about what the Bible describes. I mean, it's bigger than our ability to explain it. But that was one of the things that did stand out to me in the process of writing it, is the discovery of stories, metaphors, analogies to try to make it clear instead of hiding behind maybe $10 words in trying to talk about the cross.
Josh, what are some of those stories that seem to help people grasp it a little better?
Yeah, I tell a story. One of the models of atonement, that's kind of a word that scholars use to talk about our explanations for how Jesus saves. And I think model is a great word, because like a kid who plays with a model truck or a model airplane, it gives us real information about the real thing, but we never pretend like the model is the real thing, right? And so one of the models we talk about is that how Jesus saves as the new and the true Adam, and how he relives the human story on our behalf. And of course, the thing we bump into there is, well, wait a minute, like, how does that work? How can one person affect all of the other people? How are we bound up with Jesus? I mean, I'm not Jesus, you're not Jesus. Our kind of modern individualism causes problems sometimes for some of the biblical ways that it's talked about that we're bound together with Jesus. So one of the stories, to come back to your question, in that chapter, I tell a story from the biography of Steve Jobs. And it's by Walter Isaacson. And it's a story about Steve Jobs's father, a guy by the name of Abdullah Fattah Jindali. And he gave up Steve abandoned Steve's mother and abandoned Steve as a baby, and then went out and lived his life. And through a series of crazy events, actually ran into Steve unknowingly as an adult when Steve came in as a big kind of famous tech guru to his Mediterranean restaurant. And so the reason I tell the story is that our fallen fathers, we are bound up with them inextricably in different ways. And there's all these fascinating connections between Steve Jobs and this father that he never knew, even though they didn't grow up in the same household, and even though they didn't even really know who the other person was. And there's an analogy there for how we too are bound up with our fallen father, Adam, in sin and in some of the same patterns of brokenness that he exhibited. One of the things that's fascinating about Steve Jobs and his dad is they both ended up doing the very same thing, which is abandoning a child in the womb and then not knowing that child until years later, in exactly the same year of their life, the same month. There's all these connections between us and our fallen forebears, and we're talking about Adam, of course, in the Bible, and how Christ comes along and heals that relationship and relives this human story for us. So I think for pastors, for those of us who preach and teach, we have to try to find connections between the stories that the Bible tells about Christ and Adam and how we're bound together with others, right? Even though we don't live in the same culture, in the same context as the scriptures. And so this this connection with our fallen fathers in the story of Steve Jobs and his dad. And there's lots of other stories in there where I'm trying to find metaphors and analogies to talk about the kinds of things that the Bible talks about, but hopefully in a fresh way.
I love that. There's so much power in story. And we saw Jesus tell a lot of stories. He talks in parables a lot. Sometimes it's a good way to help get a point across, and it's memorable too. So I love that approach.
Yeah.
I think one of the areas that I've heard people question a lot is, gosh, God could just wipe away our sin. Like, why did Jesus have to die? I mean, couldn't God have done it another way? I mean, we don't want someone to die, especially an innocent person. I mean, even a good person, we get really, it's hard for us to wrestle with, like, just a good person dying, especially before their time. And here's someone who's never done anything wrong. I mean, couldn't God have come up with a better way, Josh?
Yeah. I just wrote an article about that question for one of the publishers of this book, which is Seedbed. And the title of the article, they asked for it. And the title was, Why Couldn't God Just Forgive Us? I mean, we forgive each other. Like, I have kids. I forgive them without some sort of blood sacrifice, you know, being needed. They have to forgive me. Jesus tells a story, to come back to the story point, about the prodigal son, and the father welcomes this son back home, and he doesn't make the welcome contingent upon the slaughter of, you know, the elder brother or an innocent family pet or, you know, anything like that. So that's a really good question. Why doesn't God just forgive? And so I just finished writing this article. It's going to come out on Good Friday, on kind of Crucifixion Day, fittingly. And it helped me to wrestle with some of the answers. I think, you know, one answer to that question is that our human problem, apart from Christ's work, is deeper than just a need of forgiveness. Right? It's not just that we need forgiveness. There are other elements of our sin problem that we're, in, for instance, we're enslaved to death. And so part of what Jesus is doing through his death is to break the power of him who holds the power of death, which is the devil, to quote the book of Hebrews. And so one answer to, you know, why not just forgive, is that our predicament is deeper than just a need of forgiveness. And so one of the arguments I make in the book is, because our problem is deeper than just one facet, you know, say forgiveness, then the solution is going to have to be deeper and more complex than just a sort of, I forgive you, written in the stars or something like that. And then maybe a second answer to come back, I'm not going to give all the reasons in the article, but a second answer maybe is that there is this thing called the covenant. And this is this binding agreement that God enters into with his people. It's almost like a marriage would be one metaphor to think about it. And in the covenant, if we go all the way back to the book of Genesis, there's this strange covenant ceremony where God passes between the pieces of these sacrificial animals. And it's him acting out this promise that says, very common in the ancient world, that if this covenant is broken, may, you know, what has happened to these creatures, which is death, may that happen to me. This, typically, you know, both parties in the covenant would walk between the pieces and say, essentially, look, if I break this, I know there's consequences, right? But what we see there is that God passes between the pieces, and he promises at the very beginning of the covenant that he is going to be willing to take on the debt or the penalty of his wayward bride. And so the question, well, why not just forgive? A second answer to that would be is that that's just not how the covenant was structured. And from the very beginning, God had made this binding agreement to put himself on the line to pay the price and to pay the debt for us. That's a really beautiful picture, but it's also, it carries a lot of weight to it. And it, there's more weight there than just a sort of flippant, I forgive you. We all know that in certain circumstances, a kind of flippant, I forgive you, isn't sufficient to deal with the wrong committed. And one of the analogies I use in the book is if there's a case of abuse or murder or some really heinous crime, it could be true that the victim's family forgives the perpetrator, but that doesn't necessarily remove the need for penalty or justice in that case. And I think you could say something kind of related about the cross and God's promise to go further than just a sort of flippant, I forgive you. So those are a few answers. That's a really great question. And it's one that a lot of people wrestle with.
What would you say in terms of, you know, there's many different theories on the atonement. And, you know, people try to weigh in, you know, is there one way or is there multiple, you know, yes, partial, yeah, this is right on, or part of the substitutionary, you know, how do you unpack that for folk if they're looking for, you know, understanding it?
You know, some of us have seen Lord of the Rings, or we've read, you know, Tolkien, and there's this line in there, one ring to rule them all, you know, and that has been kind of one Christian approach to Jesus's work. I'm going to find one model of atonement or one theory of atonement, and I'm going to make that the doctrine of atonement. And so maybe for some people, that model they latch onto is Christ bearing the penalty for his people. Or for other people, maybe the model that they latch onto is this triumph over death or the devil. Triumph maybe by means of some sort of a ransom or some sort of a, you know, mechanism. For other people, the thing they latch onto is that there's this transformative revelation of God's love that we see in the cross, and that changes us. So there's different models. And what I'm trying to do is really to kind of follow scripture, but also to follow generations and generations of church history in saying that there's actually more than one thing going on in the doctrine of atonement. We don't have to pick one ring to rule them all. And sometimes when we do that, we actually miss out on really beautiful, transformative elements of the gospel story. And we need to see how these different pieces actually fit together instead of being in competition in a kind of struggle for dominance. And so what the book does is I don't really use the $10 theological terms, but I do lay out four classic orthodox historic models of atonement in the book that go beyond just, you know, one Christian tradition or denomination or one century even, and to try to paint a bigger, fuller, more beautiful picture of salvation.
I love that, because I feel like so often people, you know, they might have been heard it one way, but then as their faith goes deeper, just understanding the different layers beyond just makes you more in awe of what God's done for us. Oh my goodness. The fact that God would die on the cross for me, me with all my mess, like God loves me that much. It just makes it beautiful. Yeah. I know it's got to be good news for us first, but then where do you start if you're explaining this to someone who, like, say you're this Christian that's like, I really want to share this good news with someone. They don't know anything really about the Christian faith or except for what's on TV. Like, where do you start? Like, what's the entry point? Like, if someone's truly trying to share their faith, share this good news, it's good news for them, and they're ready to share it to someone else, and they're like, how do I explain this? Where do you even start?
Yeah, I think the Spirit has to help us to know where to start, because we don't always know. And I need help as much as anybody in that. I think sometimes the place to start is different for different people. And the place to start may depend upon the element of fallenness or brokenness that they have experienced most acutely. And to be able to show how the gospel meets our deepest needs. And for some people, like, let's just say for a secular person who doesn't even know if they believe in Christ or the resurrection, right? Well, like starting with this assumption that, okay, we all know we're sinners. We all know we deserve judgment. They don't share those assumptions. So that may not be the best place to start. So one of the things I talk about in the book is it's true that atonement deals with our guilt problem and our sin problem. But what about other problems that maybe modern people are acutely aware of, but they don't get talked about in our standard kind of youth camp altar call kind of thing? And so one of the ones I talk about is shame. And it's this sense, not just that I have done wrong, but that I am wrong, that I am worthless, that I have been in some way defiled and uncovered and exposed as less than, right? And so I try to unpack, well, how does the gospel deal with our shame problem in addition to our guilt problem? And this is a really deep need that people feel, especially when they've been the victims of abuse or exploitation. And because the trouble with shame is that you can feel shame not just for what you've done, but you can feel shame for what's been done to you. There's this terrible story of Tamar in the Old Testament where she's the victim of sexual assault and she cries out to her abuser, like, where can I go to be rid of this disgrace? That's shame. And so I talk about how Jesus enters into the experience of human shame. I mean, he dies in the most shameful way imaginable for a modest Jewish man to be publicly crucified naked in front of his mom, a mocking crowd, in front of female followers. The Romans did this to maximize, not necessarily pain, but to maximize disgrace. And so how Jesus enters into our experience of shame and vulnerability. And shame can't be healed just by a punishment. It has to be shared. It has to be born. It has to be carried alongside of someone. And Jesus does that. He is entering into that experience, but he doesn't stop at the level of shame. You know, the scriptures talk about how he bore the cross and he scorned its shame, right? That he emerged on the other side in this ultimate instrument of mockery and exploitation and abuse and disgrace becomes the ultimate image of victory. And so we wear it on our bodies and we adorn our churches with the cross and we put it over our graves as a sign of hope. And it's a picture of how Christ can redeem us, not just from our guilt, but from our shame. So I tell that story because that's a way in which the gospel meets people maybe where they are, even if the needs that they are feeling maybe as a secular person aren't exactly the same ones that we would speak to in a very kind of traditional walk through the gospel. You know, you're a guilty sin, you know, that kind of thing. We can kind of try to meet people where they are, just as Jesus did.
Awesome. Well, how can someone find the book, How Jesus Saves?
Yeah, it's available. I was going to say, like I've seen on interviews for other books, like wherever books are sold, I guess it's on the, you know, it's definitely available on Amazon. It's a dual imprint from Seedbed and Zondervan Reflectives. And so you can buy it from their websites, the Seedbed website or the Zondervan website. But one of the things I'm excited about is, since this is for, like the subtitle says, it's for ordinary people, there's different ways that folks can take it in. So I recorded an audiobook for it, for folks who maybe they want to learn about the gospel, learn about how Jesus saves, but they're not big readers or they don't have time. And so you can listen to it on the commute or while you're running or while you're walking the dog. That's one way. And then there's also videos that we've put together for church small groups who want to watch, you know, a short teaching by me on each chapter. And then there's questions to discuss and grow together. So So it's available wherever, Amazon, Seedbed, Zondervan, but there's also different forms so people can approach it from whatever angle is easiest or best for them.
Awesome. Cal, you were going to hop in?
I was going to say, I love that it's in all those different ways. So everyone, the gospel is for everyone, friends. It is for you. It is for your young child that is trying to avoid bedtime with complex theological questions. It is for your neighbor. It is for your family. It is for your coworkers. It's for all that you meet. So Josh, thanks for sharing with us about how Jesus saves and what it means for us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
So friends, share this podcast with someone you know who needs to hear it. And in the meantime, remember, we are better together. God bless.